We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
It is Saturday, the 25th of April, in the glorious future year of 2026, and I am coming to you from a garret, that really is the only word for it, in London, about a block away from the British Museum, which simultaneously pleases and frustrates me. The weather here in London is beautiful today, which is a major contributory cause of my frustration. And I know you're wondering, what in the world is this madman talking about? And I get to that, I swear. I'm pre-recording this for two reasons. One is that I don't trust the hotel Wi-Fi, if hotel is really the word for this lodgings, to support a live show. And the other is that I'm concerned I may be asleep by then. In fact, last night, I tried to record a show for today. Yeah. In my stateroom on the Caledonian Sleeper, somewhere between Inverness and Edinburgh, and I jerked awake to find that I had fallen asleep while recording and was talking absolute gibberish. Which might be entertaining, but was not the message that I wanted to convey to you. Now, I slept poorly last night, and I don't blame the Caledonian Sleeper. I blame this sore throat that I've been experiencing, and I don't know what the cause of it is. My hope is that I'm not developing some kind of a sinus infection like the one I had a couple of years ago that caused my left eye to swell shut. Had to have intravenous antibiotics for that. It was bad, 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 friends. That's the only word. But it might be just exposure to the diesel fumes from the old grumbly, growly rail diesel cars that ScotRail uses for service on the Highland Line between Inverness and Thurso. A sort of Inverness, Thurso, and Wick. Thurso and Wick are at the ends of two branches which divided a place called Georgemus Junction. They're the two principal port towns in Caithness at the northern end of Britain. And there's no route that would allow you to serve both of them because the coast is too rugged. Anyway, of course, Thurso is where I was at. And I went to Thurso because it is the nearest town to Dunray, where Britain, of course, built its pioneering fast breeder reactors, the DFR and the PFR. And then, for no reason that anyone can really explain, threw in the towel in the late 80s and decided, no, we're just going to ignore the fact that, unlike most countries, we have a large stockpile of separated civilian plutonium. We're going to ignore the fact that the North Sea oil is bound to run out, and as a matter of fact, one of the political controversies in Caithness at the moment revolves exactly around that because of the declining productivity of the North Sea fields, investment in them is declining, and that has negative consequences on the people and industries of the region. Who could have predicted such a thing? Certainly not the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, which moved there in the 1950s, creating educational institutions and bringing in lots of people and so on, in order to develop an energy resource which would not suffer from the problem of rising cost of production and declining efficiency of production. The breeder reactor makes the cost of primary uranium virtually irrelevant, and since its costs of operation are essentially based on technology, the more the technology is refined, the less the power from the breeder reactor will cost. And this means that we can move away from the boom and bust cycles that are always associated with the fossil fuel industries. Now I have to come for a moment and talk to you a little bit about Caith Ness, because you're accustomed to thinking of Scotland as consisting of lowlands and highlands. And Caith Ness is neither. Caith Ness, and actually Sutherland to the south of it, which used to be just the southern part of Caith Ness, are north of the highlands. They were never colonized by the Scots, the Gaels. Thurso means Thor's River. The village or town there was founded by the Vikings, and the place was a part of the Earldom of Orkney, and only passed to Scotland when the Earldom of Orkney passed from the Norwegian crown to the Scottish crown. Before that, it was, so far as we can know, held by the people we call the Picts, of whom we know shockingly little, considering that they did adopt Christianity, and one would have thought they might adopt the Roman written language along with it, which happened so many places in the world, and then we would have parish registers or records of the names of things in Pictish, and we don't. We have no attested writing from the Picts. We have virtually no attested language from the Picts. The best scholarly consensus at the moment is that it was a Brythonic language somehow related to Welsh. But that's an inference. There's not really a lot of evidence to support it. And the reason that the Scots clansmen who came over from Ireland originally, that's what the word Scot means, is an Irishman, Scotus, like Duns Scotus or John Scotus Origena, two great theologians. The reason that the Scots clans never moved into Caith Ness is really very simple, that like the Orkney Islands, half a billion years ago, more or less, for the most part of, well, at least 50 million, if not 100 million years, the whole place was a shallow lake known as Lake Orcadia, after the Orkneys. And so the terrain of most of Caith Ness is extremely flat. And you might say, well, what does that have to do with anything? You know, it's not like the Scots, Highland Scots, are known as Highland Scots because they were terrified of flat land. No, it's the thing is, the whole place is referred to as the Flow Country. It's basically a single enormous peat bog. Colossal peat bog. And so there's not really a lot of fresh surface water other than bog water. You know, and it's a very difficult country to pass through on foot. It's only the seacoast fringes sort of at the northeastern edge are particularly amenable to human habitation, and those are mostly reached by sea. Or at least were until the Highland Railway was put in the late 19th century. And again, even they had the problem that they had to strike out inland because the seacoast was topographically rugged. Anyhow, one of the consequences of this having been the bottom of a great lake is that there's layered sediments. And those layered sediments are the foundation, quite literally, of one of the major industries of the area, which is flagstone. Now, interestingly, the land around the Caithness fringes, sort of between the peat bog and the seacoast, is suitable for agriculture, and once the ice sheets had retreated, agriculturalists migrated there at least 5,000 years ago and have been growing grain and so on ever since. It's just that, again, we know very, very little about their language, their culture, anything about them, even in the final stages, the Pictish stages. Yeah, we can infer that they practiced ancestor worship from the kinds of tombs they constructed, but that's not a difficult inference, because it's common among agriculturalists. Anyway, but yes, yeah, so flagstone is important. Another consequence of this sedimentary deposition cycle is that lots and lots and lots of fossil fishes have been found there since the mid-19th century when people started looking for them. Anyway, so the museum in Caithness, which I went to see, has sort of three basic departments. And Department 1 is all about Dounreay, and I got lots of good photographs of that. And then the second department is about the landscape and its extension in space at the modern day and its extension in time back into the past, with particular emphasis on some notable biologists and geologists who lived in and studied the region. And then the third division is the archaeology. Now, Thurso is the northernmost town in Britain. It is, of course, not the northernmost town in Scotland, because Scotland as a country incorporates the Orkney and Shetland Islands, which are north of Britain, right? Britain is an island. Great Britain, if we want to differentiate it from the peninsula that pokes off of the northwest corner of France, which was known to the Romans as Little Britain and to us of today as Brittany. One way or the other. But, so I went there and I spoke to the folks at the Nuclear Restoration Service, I think it is anyway, somehow related to the Nuclear Decommissioning Agency. They change the names of things all the time up there, who are responsible for the Dounreay site. And I gave them some of my stickers and a couple of copies of Blast and said that there's those of us who really do still believe that the work that was done at Dounreay was very important. And I went into some charity shops to see if they had anything interesting for sale, and didn't find a lot. But at one of them, I talked to the lady working the till, actually, and within a few minutes, she was just saying, you know, that she thought that everything I said was wonderful. And so I gave her a couple of copies of Blast and some stickers. And then when I went to the museum, the North Coast Visitor Center. Then I also gave a couple of copies of Blast to the folks who were working at the museum there. And as I say, I got some good photographs of the Dounreay exhibits, which include dummy fuel assemblies from both the original DFR, Dounreay Fast Reactor, and the later PFR, Prototype Fast Reactor. The thing about PFR being, of course, that it was designed, as the name implies, as a prototype for the commercial fast breeder, and so its components were not sized to work efficiently at the 150 megawatt power level of PFR. They were sized to work efficiently at the 1,000 to 1,500 megawatt level. And indeed, so far as I'm aware, PFR never actually achieved net fuel breeding. They did, however, reprocess fuel from both DFR and PFR on-site and refabricate both uranium and uranium-plutonium fuels there at Dounreay. As a matter of fact, they did more than that, because they also had another reactor there for a while, the Dounreay Materials Testing Reactor. MTR is a type of reactor pioneered by the United States in the late 40s, and there were a number of them built, one at Lucas Heights in Australia, for example, one at Rizzo in Denmark. And Dounreay actually fabricated fuel for export to other MTR users, which I found quite interesting. MTR, original style MTR fuel elements, use highly enriched uranium canned in aluminium. And these elements have a fairly short lifespan and have to be reprocessed at the end of each working cycle. And so Dounreay handled that for a number of customers. That materials testing reactor that they had there had a relatively short operating life simply because its job of irradiating samples in a high neutron fluxes was rapidly taken over by DFR itself. And so once that MTR was shut down, DMTR was shut down, and the fuel removed, it was just sort of left to sit for years. Anyway, and so the whole control room set up, the desk, and then also the wall panels with their chart recorders and meters and annunciator boards, was just left, and the museum there got hold of it and have it set up, which is pretty nifty. Anyhow, but one of the more striking artifacts, in fact, I would probably say the most striking artifact in the collection, is this stainless steel prism, of which the plan is a six-pointed star. And it's about it's not much more than a meter and a half high. I could see over the top of it, despite the fact the base of it was up off the ground. Anyway, and the labeling says that it's the first DFR core. Really the core cage, obviously the fuel itself having been removed. I'm not sure that's correct, and I'm not sure it's not correct. Because the thing is that ordinarily, a thing that had been in a reactor core would be much too radioactive to put in a place where the public could be close to it and, in fact, touch it. But there's two phenomena here that are important. The first phenomenon is that in stainless steel, which is what this is made of, the main problem that you get hold of is the conversion of cobalt, which can never be completely eliminated from nickel, to radio cobalt. Well, radio cobalt has a half-life of about 6 years, and it's been 70 years since that, more or less, since that first core was used, and so it's possible, so that would have been more than 10 half-lives, so the radiation from cobalt-60 would have largely disappeared. And secondly, that first core was only used briefly for low-power testing. It was used for critical work, but it was only used briefly for low-power testing. And so it's possible that that is the real reactor core on display, although it's not roped off or anything. At the Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas, they have one of the NERVA nuclear rocket engine cores, and that is behind a plexiglass shield that says, "Do not touch." That's another one that was used only for low-power testing. Of course, very different materials used in it, mostly graphite. Anyway, so I'm not completely certain. If it's not the actual original core, I can't say core vessel, but core structure, then it's something very closely related because, as I said, I was able to look at the top of it and I noted the scribed marks left by the machinists showing the three axes of the triangular layout, right? Which were labeled X, Y, and Z. And I know that's how the Dounreay core, the DFR core, was laid out. So, either it's the actual original core cage structure, or, and this strikes me as slightly more likely, it is the model, exact one-to-one model, really not even a model, but a duplicate, that was used for training and planning purposes and checking fit and finish and so on to make sure that you could actually assemble the core and all those nice things. So yeah, I do not know the exact provenance of that item. Now, I bought a book from the folks at the Nuclear Restoration Service offices and information center. They had a couple of other books on display in the case, but they couldn't sell them to me. What they said was they didn't have any copies available because they had given them all away to people who used to work at the site. And I said, well, in that case, if you don't have them for sale, could you sell me your display copies? But they didn't think they could do that. Suffice to say, the people they have at the front desk counter at the visitor center, public information center, are not their most senior people, and they just didn't feel like they could make that decision. Which is a pity, because now I'm going to have to look for those books in the secondary market. And for all that a good third of its floor space on two floors, maybe even more like half of the floor space of the whole museum, is allocated to Dounreay work, the North Coast Visitor Center does not have a lot of material. They don't have souvenirs, right, in the gift shop, is what I'm saying. They do not have a lot of much of anything in the gift shop. No Dounreay, you know, not much of anything aside from the book that I'd already bought from the Nuclear Restoration Service people, which was a great disappointment. I was hoping, you know, given they have an exhibit of all kinds of stuff, commemorative spoons, a lighter. So, you know, the original DFR was enclosed in a containment sphere, and somebody made a commemorative lighter, a dome-shaped lighter in the shape of the containment sphere. Which, admittedly, was not difficult to do. But they don't really have any memorabilia like that, which, in my mind, is a great pity. Anyway, I was going to explain to you what was going on with the British Museum and the fact that I can't get in because I don't have a smartphone. And this is all because of the weather being nice today. Well, and because it's a Saturday. You may remember an old song, A Foggy Day in London Town, where the singer says, the British Museum kind of lost its charm, and I always said, that would take a very long time for me. But the trouble is exactly the opposite at the moment. It is a lovely sunny day in London Town. And as a result, everybody's out enjoying the lovely sunny weather. And so, in this particular area, everybody's congregated around the entrances of the British Museum. Well, the British Museum have adopted a timed entry policy. And the way this works basically is that you can sign up for a time slot, or you can just, you go to their, you take your smartphone, you get their app, you do the thing, and it tells you, you know, sometime 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes from now. Well, and then you show your smartphone to the guys at the gate, and they let you in at when the time comes up, right? Well, what happens if you don't have a smartphone? Well, the answer is you have to wait until sometime that they don't have the sign outside saying, timed entry only, no availability for casual visitors. Because that's the thing, is that because of all the people who are out right now, they've, you know, the place is full, basically. The British Museum is bustling with people, and so they are not allowing people in except by the timed entry system. If it were raining today, I would have got in easily. As it is, I might try to get in briefly tomorrow, but as I think I told you already, I have tickets for a steam-up at an old water-pumping station which is adjacent to the Kew Bridge Railway Station. And so that's my, and since I had to pay for that ticket, that's my focus at the moment. I'm a bit disappointed, though, to tell you that I did not get to the Hopetoun Museum in Darlington while I was staying in York. The 2 days that I was in York, I was just so utterly tired that I did not get out of my hotel room until afternoon. And the thing is, it's, well, it's a half hour. I mean, Darlington is the next place up from York, and by the fast train, it's like a half hour. And then you got to wait for the local train to take you to the North Road station from Banktop station. And if the schedule's bad for that, those trains don't run all that frequently. They should run a lot more frequently than they do. Anyway, and so not being up and about until afternoon was not something that was conducive to actually getting to the museum in Darlington. Which is my own fault, obviously, but I was hoping that I could possibly go back this coming weekend when I will be staying in Blackpool, because there are pretty direct services between Blackpool and York. The only problem is that the line between Darlington and York is going to be closed over this next weekend because it's the bank holiday weekend and they've already planned to do big engineering works. So I'm just out of luck. I will have to hit the Hopetoun Museum in Darlington at some other date. Anyway, so that gives you a précis of what I've been doing. Now, I mentioned last week Pannonian ethanol, a big train of tanker cars full of ethanol from presumably Hungary, and walking around here just near the British Museum, there was some filming for some kind of upcoming movie going on earlier in the day, and there's a bunch of trucks of the kind that you associate with filming activities, some of which are labeled as running on, you know, diesel engines, running on vegetable oil, and my comment about both of these is that environmentally, it's not a good idea, all right? Biofuels, just say no to biofuels. But particularly, of course, in the conditions of the oil market right now today, I can understand blending ethanol or vegetable oil into your fuel supply as a matter of autarky. In other words, having something that nobody can cut you off from the supply of. As a matter of fact, von Braun remarked on this, that while the German Air Force was paralyzed in the last stage of the Second World War because they didn't have motor fuel for their airplanes, his V-2s only required ethanol and liquid oxygen. Liquid oxygen, of course, was not difficult to obtain at all, and the availability of ethanol was largely agricultural, and they still had control of significant agricultural land, so that wasn't a problem as such. Anyway, but that's about all that I have to say. I'm looking forward to seeing Stug at the end of the week. I hope he's having fun with his scouting activities. And as always, you can write to me, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America, and I will pick up your letters and read them when I get back to the U.S. in early June. And other than that, if you enjoy these broadcasts and would like to support them, I always welcome you to send me money, paypal.me/prometheuslives, or for a recurring contribution, patreon.com/man_and_atom. And coming up next is Tobe with the Dubious Goals Committee. And that's all, folks.